And welcome to the Deep Dive Radio Show. As always, I'm your host, Nick Espinoza, and we're going to be talking about all things cybersecurity, cyber warfare, and technology related. And I think we're one of the only ones out there that's doing that right now. If you'd like to be part of the radio show in any way, shape, or form, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. Or you can send us an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. We have an action-packed show as always. There's always a lot to cover, so stick around with us as we deep dive into a topic and we catch up on everything else. So without further ado, let's begin. And we have a great show for you this week. We are wrapping up the end of the year here a little bit, but it is not my final show. But what we're going to do is a series of smaller deep dives, let's say more shallow dives, but deep dives nevertheless, on a lot of different topics that happened this year that I think are very important that I simply just didn't have time to do a whole bunch of deep dives on, just given my show. So with that, sit back and let's explore multiple topics that affect our security, our privacy, our technology, and literally our everyday life. So stick around and let's begin. And this mini deep dive is I'm basically crashing an airplane. And I'm not talking about shooting it out of the sky. I am not talking about hacking into it to, let's say, make it crash in some way, shape, or form. I'm talking about simply turning lights off on buildings. And here's what's going on, because this is a massive problem with Internet of Things that we have right now. And if you're not familiar with obstruction light control, it's simply this. These are lights that are placed on structures like tall buildings to warn airplanes not to hit them. These were exposed and open to the internet, meaning hackers could have turned the lights off or changed their colors or dim them if they had the capability and all of this kind of stuff. Now, a researcher named Amity Dan basically discovered this issue. Now, Dan found at least 46 control panels online for lighting systems, including Baltimore, Tuscaloosa, Illinois, Decatur, Texas, and some others, as well as Ontario, Canada, according to the IP addresses that he was able to find and search. And some of these look like very tall cell phone towers. Obviously, if it's in the dark, and it's not a full-blown structure, a plane could easily hit an incredibly tall cell tower. This is why we light them. One panel that Dan showed Motherboard by Vice, who was the organization that reported on this, included controls such as force day, force twilight, and force night. In other words, he could change and fluctuate how the lights would behave and even turn them off. So he alerted both the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, and as well as the maker of these light systems, Dialight. Now, part of the FAA's response was, and I quote, "It appears that this vulnerability allows users to access a control panel of the obstruction light control system and provides controls to change the intensity of the light fixtures, turning them on, turning them off." And so here we are. We can simply break in, and I know exactly where Dan went, Mr. Dan went to search for these open lights. It's basically an IoT search engine that a lot of researchers and hackers can use. It's open to the public. And he was able to identify these things, and by virtue of that, probe this information. And so here we have a major part of our economy and our sector, which is air travel. You know, I travel constantly for my job, and it's kind of a terrifying thought that I could be sitting on an airplane, and the airplane is 100% perfectly fine, but somebody on the ground is basically turning lights off on tall buildings, tall structures, and anything. I mean, we've already seen that, you know, a plane can be weaponized, thanks, unfortunately, to September 11th. And so what if it's inadvertently weaponized? If, let's say, the lights on the Sears Tower or, you know, the Empire State Building or, you know, or any one of these other large edifices around the globe gets turned off and the plane basically clips it, hits it, you know, does whatever because it assumes its flight path is clear. That's a serious issue. And obviously, it's more likely, I think, that probably a very tall cell tower would, probably smaller planes that fly at lower altitudes than the big jetliners. But the fact remains the same is that we don't have to actually hit the device or the vehicle itself, or in this case, an airplane. We can impact the environment to impact what we are trying to hit. So I'll give you this other example. When driverless cars were first being tested, vetted, and all of this, obviously they would put them onto fake roads, fake courses, and all of that. So, you know, it would stop at a stop sign, you know, it wouldn't hit the cardboard children walking across the way. It knew not to run into buildings and all of this. Researchers were able to get that thing to blow right through an intersection by simply covering covering the stop sign with a black plastic bag. The car couldn't see the stop sign, and so it assumed it was perfectly fine to go through the intersection completely unopposed. This is what we're talking about. I mean, this is a very serious issue. We can impact environment, left and right to get what we want. I mean, we can flood out buildings to destroy evidence and all of this. And when we have such a centralized internet connected infrastructure where even our lighting control systems are being, touched over the internet, or let's say the HVAC building control system, in that sense, there's no reason why somebody couldn't be able to hack in if it's insecure, and let's say just shut down a building or shut off the lights or, change the behavior in this in some way, shape, or form. I mean, it's a very serious problem that we have, and we're not really doing much about this. And so I'm glad that this was discovered. I'm glad that this environmental effect for air travel is going to be hopefully hardened and more secured. But I think it just really underscores the broader issue we have with all the insecurity in IoT, in Internet of Things. You know, we have so many people who leave the default password as password and then plug in these video cameras. And, here we are. They can be exposed over the internet. I've literally done live demonstrations to audiences on stage where I go through and I just randomly search and say, okay, here's, let's say, 10 webcams from around the world. Let's go log into this one from Germany. And I literally get prompted for a username and password. I should never be able to see that. And then probably 50% of the time, I can just use the default passwords on that camera system, and I can literally get in and I can show a live audience how I can control a video camera. It's crazy. And people don't understand this kind of stuff. And I think we really need to start ramping up the education on this, because quite frankly, we're in the dark. And hopefully no plane would be in the dark by virtue of this. And so that is your mini deep dive of the week, I guess, at least as it revolves around IoT. And in this mini deep dive, I am asking the question, can government-created apps be trusted? Now, let's look at one serious example of this from China. Now, basically the app we're going to be talking about here is the Study the Great Nation app for Android and iPhone. And here's what's going on. This comes from a little earlier in the year. This became one of the most downloaded free programs in China thanks to persuasive demands by Chinese authorities that citizens download and install this. So there you go. This is actually being tied to their social credit system, which rewards citizens in various ways, one of which is apparently to use this app in their everyday life. Now, this app pushes out official news and images, and it encourages people to earn points for their social score by reading articles, commenting on them, and then playing quizzes about China and its leader, Xi Jinping. Now, the use of this app is apparently mandatory among party officials and civil servants, and it is actually tied to wages in some workplaces. And so starting basically in October or so, native journalists must pass a test on the life of President Xi that is basically delivered via this app in order to obtain a press card, which enables them to do their job. And so basically, if you are a member of the press in China and you do not pass this pass the test on the current president, they're not actually going to issue you press credentials. But here's the terrifying thing about this. On behalf of the Open Technology Fund, which campaigns on human rights issues, a German cybersecurity firm known as Cure53 took apart the Android version of the app and said it found many undocumented and hidden features. Cure53 said Study the Great Nation had, and I quote, extensive logging, unquote, abilities, and seemed to try and build up a list of the popular apps an individual had installed on their phone. So, in other words, this app was cataloging all of the other apps that it had on this individual's phone. Now, the app gives the government super user access, according to Cure53. The app also weakened encryption, basically used to protect private data and messages, making it easier for the government to basically break into the phone and crack the security if it wanted to read anything. And I quote the report. The app contains code resembling a backdoor, which is able to run arbitrary commands with super user privileges. Now, Cure53 has said there was no evidence that this high-level access was being used, but said it was not clear why any educational app, and that's the foundation of this app, would need such access to a phone. And I think that's a very interesting topic that we have here, because quite frankly, when we have a government's quite frankly like to surveil. I don't care if it's free and open or more free and open societies. I mean, if we look at what's going on in London in the UK, they have put up closed circuit television all throughout the streets of London to monitor and record everything. We see a lot of different surveillance techniques that are being deployed here in the United States as well, not to mention Ring Doorbell by Amazon having a very close and personal relationship with over 600 law enforcement agencies across the United States. This could be the local police up to the federal level that are taking the Ring Doorbell footage without a warrant and being able to read it. And so as we are looking at this, our government couldn't create apps for us. So let's say, the IRS creates an app for us to, get information and more easily pay parking tickets, pay our taxes. Or maybe the Forest Service goes ahead and creates an app, that gives you more information on the land that or the parks that you're going to go to. And here we are. Who is checking these things? We don't have necessarily a Cure 53, a cybersecurity outfit that is going through every government issued app in the Western world here and saying, okay, these are good, these are bad, these are giving the government super access. It's weakening the encryption standard. Now, we know China's an authoritarian government, and so it makes sense for them to do that in that sense. They have been censoring, they have been locking down, they have been monitoring, and they've been teaching other authoritarian governments how to do this, Vietnam being the perfect example of that. And so this ends up being, I think, a very serious issue we have, with this, in the sense that as we are downloading and installing things, one, we don't necessarily know everything that we don't necessarily know who is making these apps. Most people don't research this, but when it's coming from an actual government, how can we trust it in the sense that it can be used as a tool for surveillance? Very similar in the same way an app from, let's say, an insurance company, let's say for auto insurance, could typically or could potentially rather turn on a GPS and then see that you've been speeding potentially, and then you lose your good speeder discount because, even though you haven't had a ticket, they've literally proven it to you through the use of your technology. We are giving these organizations and these governments apparently a gateway into this. So when you are thinking about this and you have to download some kind of app that is the government, obviously I don't think there's any government apps that are required for citizens here in the United States. But it's something to consider because we don't necessarily know how these things are developed, deployed, and what rules or permissions that they are circumventing in both iPhone and Android. So it's a serious issue that we have to talk about, and here we are. And so that is your mini deep dive here, on government-issued apps and just some of the terrifying consequences that we have for this. And I think it's also one of those reasons why trust is at an all-time low, especially when it comes to a government. So that is your mini deep dive of the moment. You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM. And this mini deep dive is on how to run a disinformation campaign and how it actually costs and how much it actually costs. And we are literally sitting on a new election. Everybody knows here in the United States, and if you're watching this elsewhere, you might know as well, we are ramping up to another major presidential election in 2020 that will be hotly contested. And we are once again going to see a whole bunch of disinformation come out. And so this reporting is from Ars Technica, but I think it's actually rather fascinating. So researchers from Recorded Futures Insect Group describe how they engaged two providers of advertising disinformation services to assess the threat posed by such operations. Both disinformation operators were advertising services on Russian language underground forums alongside purveyors of hacking tools and other criminal activities. But one of the services also had a public internet presence, offering less illicit marketing services through an open website. And so the first step that Recorded Future took was to build a fake company with fake information and really build it up. So they basically talked to a hacker known as Raskolnikov, and basically this is according to the report from Recorded Future, this person said that he could publish as many articles as the researchers wanted and even claimed to be able to place stories on the Financial Times and BuzzFeeds, though those would cost an incredible amount of money. And so some of his prices for building a fake company and giving it fake positive reviews and reports was $150 US for Facebook and other social media accounts and content, $200 for LinkedIn accounts and content, $350 to $550 per month for social media marketing, $45 for a news article up to 1,000 characters, $65 to contact a media source directly to spread material, and $100 per 10 comments for a given article or news story. Now, the effort also included creation of generic news articles about how great this fictitious company was. The researchers from Recorded Future opted for two articles at lesser-known outlets, and within 2 weeks, after some rewrites because of the non-native English they used in the article, the fake company articles had been placed and published. One, and I quote, was a less established media outlet, according to the report, while the other was, and I quote, a very reputable source that had published a newspaper for nearly a century. The total cost of building a fake company and then having it promoted to look completely legitimate cost Recorded Future $1,850. That's it. That's all it cost them to build a fake company that could start perpetuating itself online. Now, round two of this was to basically tear it all down. And so they contacted an individual to basically go after the fictitious company that they just created, and they're calling that individual Dr. Zhivago, which, you know, if you get the joke, haha. Now, Dr. Zhivago's prices for tearing this company down was $15 for an article up to 1,000 characters, $8 in all U.S. currency, mind you, $8 for social media posts and commentary up to 1,000 characters, $10 for Russian to English translation up to 1,800 characters, $25 for other language translation up to 2,000 characters, $1,500 for SEO or search engine optimization services to further promote social media posts and traditional media articles within a time frame of 10 to 15 days. Now, the first stage focused on placing articles on news websites. The price list for targeted sites was divided into, quote, low profile, medium profile, and top level. So these sites were like Reuters.com, Newsmax, and Mashable were listed on the top level as well, which is absolutely crazy. One of the articles once the articles were posted, aged accounts, in other words, older social media profiles less likely to be flagged as fraudulent, would repost the stories, and then other accounts would comment and repost. And so they basically were able to go ahead and write major damning news stories on their fake company, have it posted, promoted, shared by accounts that were less likely to get flagged as fraudulent, and tore the other company down. That cost them $4,200 US. So in the span of about, what, $6,000 or so, they were able to build a company and completely tear it down. Now, both disinformation operators, both the one that built it up and the other that teared it down, offered to go even harder at the targets. So, for example, Dr. Zhivago, he was the one that was tearing it down, offered to file a complaint with law enforcement claiming that the targeted fake company was involved in human trafficking. Raskolnikov, this is the one that built it up, was quick to offer negative services as well, including takedown operations to ruin the reputation of a competitor or, quote, sink an opponent in an election, among other things. And so here we are, guns for hire, you know, for about $5,000 to $6,000. And if you're not building a fake company, you're probably spending less than $5,000, and you can start sowing disinformation on a literally an elected potential candidate, another company, all these kinds of things. That's terrifying, and that's the world that we live in. And one of the biggest issues that we have is that a lot of people just don't read past the headline. A lot of people believe what they read online without any kind of, real discretion, real filter, objective reading in terms of questioning what they are seeing to verify facts. We've seen time and again where people have said, well, you know, I believe this and you can't change my mind. You know, it's really that simple. I think both sides of the political spectrum do that. It's a very serious problem. But here we have verifiable proof of how to build something up that's fake and make it reputable, and verified proof of how to tear something down, including calling law enforcement, child trafficking complaints, all this kind of stuff. That is a very serious issue, and it's very cheap to do. So take that for what it's worth. But as we come into the 2020 election, keep it in mind. And this has been another mini deep dive. And this mini deep dive is on Facebook because Facebook is saying that they're now going to let you opt out of tracking. Or are they? And here's what's going on. Now, back in September, Facebook updated its local location privacy settings for its users. And I quote the company, "Facebook is better with location." And basically, they said that you are now free to turn off your location tracking, and the company would be happy to basically tell you how to do that. You know, however, that setting of turning off your location tracking within the Facebook app comes with a massive, massive loophole. And two U.S. senators are now asking Facebook to basically explain themselves. And so basically in September, they published a blog post clarifying the way it gathers user location data from mobile apps. So fall updates in both Android and iOS, that's Android 10 and iOS 13, those are the new versions of each operating system, spurred the changes. And Facebook said at the time that both the operating system would allow for more granular location control, and by virtue of that, the Facebook app would as well. And so for Android users, Facebook said it will continue to respect, and I quote, continue to respect your most restrictive setting choices. If your device location setting is set to all of the time, but your Facebook background location setting is off, we won't collect your precise location information when you're not using the Facebook app. For Apple users, it basically said, in addition to the three existing location settings, always, never, or only, basically, it would also now allow once option for location data. That's in addition to additional notifications about when the app is using your precise location, as well as how many times the app accesses that information. But in one line near the end of the blog post, Facebook writes, "We may still understand your location using things like check-ins, events, and information about your internet connection." And that's where U.S. senators are getting involved. So Senator Chris Coons and Josh Hawley, Coons is a Democrat from Delaware and Hawley is a Republican from Missouri, sent a letter to Facebook asking the company how exactly it tracks user locations, even when location access and location history are disabled. And so this is the thing that we have to realize. Obviously, if you are going somewhere and your location is set off and you say, oh, I'm checking into X restaurant, Facebook's going to know that address because that restaurant probably has a Facebook page. It's publicly accessible. Your cellular connection can track you as well. We can track through cellular Wi-Fi, through cellular triangulation, even if you turn off location. Ask Google. So if you have an Android phone and you say basically turn off my GPS, Google can still track you through cellular triangulation. If you connect to Wi-Fi, the public IP address of that Wi-Fi is going to be geolocated. We geolocate IP addresses for work all the time when we are looking up to say, okay, where is this traffic coming from? And we can get pretty much in the ballpark of where an IP address is located. And here's the thing. On top of all of this, and I'm glad that the senators want answers, Facebook was about to take this kind of violation for not only location, but also privacy one step further, which is the second half of this mini deep dive here. Facebook confirmed that it built a now defunct app for its employees that used facial recognition technology to identify coworkers and their friends. This is according to CNET. Now, Business Insider first broke this story a couple of weeks ago, citing multiple anonymous sources who claimed that employees could simply point their phone at somebody for the app to recognize that person's name and profile picture, and that one version, providing you fed it enough data, could track down anyone on the platform. It was purportedly developed between 2015 and 2016, which is obviously before the whole Cambridge Analytica scandal broke. And basically, it was they made the app defunct. They stopped working on it. But typically, when a company of that size uses or develops apps for their internal employee population to use, it's running as a beta test. They want to see if the employees love it, hate it, if it works, hone it, fix it, tweak it, whatever that is. But imagine being able to walk down the street, you know, and you see somebody, you're like, oh, that, I know that person. Do I know that person? And you're able to pick up your phone, and thanks to the high resolution of the camera, it's able to basically snap a picture of that person's face or identify them, take that picture and then identify them in the massive facial recognition database that is Facebook. And so I'm walking down the street. You don't know me. I don't know you. And I say, you know what? I want to know something about it. Something's not right. Or I think I know that person or, you know, whatever. And I can basically hold up my phone and Facebook will instantly give me your information, location, absolutely everything. I think that is a massive violation of privacy, and it's a huge, huge thing. And so even though they're letting us opt out of tracking, they're still tracking us in multiple ways, you know, so they've given us a great big button that we can push that says, oh, now I feel great because Facebook, you know, I'm off the grid for Facebook, when you absolutely are not, because they're still tracking you through various different ways. They're just basically doing a sleight of hand. And then, as we see, this is bolstered by the fact that they were developing internal apps that would require really good location information, no matter how they get it, in order to basically put up anybody on the planet. Not to mention the fact that, let's say I took that picture of that person and searched, and they weren't anywhere in Facebook. I've now just added that person against their will to Facebook's facial recognition system, and I've tagged their location. So if I'm walking through, I don't know, Des Moines, Iowa, you know, I don't even think I've ever been to Des Moines, but let's say I'm walking through Des Moines and I do that to somebody and that person in Des Moines, you know, just doesn't have, is not in Facebook, I've just put them in there. I think that's crazy, and it could be in LA or New York or Chicago or anywhere, but I picked, you know, just some random, you know, random place in the middle of the country. And here we are. And so how do we actually stop this? How do we actually prevent this? We need to start creating laws that are keeping in pace with the technology. Our technology has exploded past where our laws are, and I'll be talking about that as well in another one of these mini deep dives here, but it is a serious, serious issue, and we have to make sure that we are continuously keeping the Facebooks of the world accountable for what they're doing. And when they're saying that they're actually not tracking our location, it should mean they're not tracking our location, not that they're just simply not tracking our location via one method and they're still using another three. So take that for what it's worth, but that is your Facebook, you know, mini deep dive of the week. And stay tuned to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show as we take a quick break for a public service announcement. We'll be back right after that.